You know, the further we looked into it, when you Google Y2K, the first images that come up are like empty grocery store shelves and people lined around the block at gun stores and sort of the same subcultures in America that were pervading the media landscape then were also around in 2020, the summer of 2020. So we made this connection immediately and realized that there was like a lot to dig into beyond just, you know, this, what we think of as Y2K today, but the actual computer error and that effect on society.
You are listening to the Screen Slate podcast. I'm your host, John Derringer, and on this episode, I am thrilled to be joined by Brian Becker and Marley McDonald, directors of the fantastic new documentary Time Bomb Y2K, an all-archival retelling of events surrounding turn-of-the-millennium digital hysteria. The film drops on HBO December 30, and ahead of that, it runs today, December 15th through Thursday, December 21st at DC TV's Firehouse Cinema, where I'm hosting a Q&A with the filmmakers at 8 p.m. on Saturday night. There's also an accompanying series called Cyberspaces and Millennial Traces, which we talk about here. And it includes Small Town Ecstasy from 2002, which is about a dad who gets really into raves. And that's 6 p.m. right before the Time Bomb screening I'm hosting. One other quick plug, earlier that day, Screen Slate is tabling at the N+1 Holiday Market at the N+1 offices in Greenpoint. So I'll be there all day, 12 to 5 p.m., along with Screen Slate friends. Come say hello, grab some merch, see our friends from Topos in the film desk, and pick up some unique and perhaps highbrow holiday gifts. This episode is brought to you by Film at Lincoln Center and their comprehensive Edward Yang program. You can spend the holidays at Walter Reed Theater fully immersed in the works of one of the greatest filmmakers of the Taiwanese New Wave. The retrospective marks brand new restorations of two of Yang's rarely screened works, Mahjong with a new 4K version that will have its world premiere as part of the series, and the new restoration of A Confucian Confusion. And in addition to some well-known favorites from the director, the retrospective also includes several of Yang's seldom screened films, including That Day on the Beach, his first theatrical feature, The Winter of 1905, directed by Yu Wei Chang from Yang's script, and an excerpt from Yang's unfinished animated martial arts film, The Wind, whose production was halted after his death. Do not miss Desire Expectations, the films of Edward Yang, at Film at Lincoln Center from December 22nd through January 4th. Also want to shout out to our Screen Slate Patreon members who are far and away the number one way that we're able to support ourselves and keep going. The Patreon members are the people who honestly and truly make everything possible. So if you want to support our work, visit patreon.com/screenslate. All right, here we go. All right, we are here with Brian Becker and Marley McDonald in Screen Slate HQ.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey.
Directors of the new film Time Bomb Y2K, premiering on the
30th on HBO. But premiering on the 15th at DC TV.
Downtown Community Television Center.
Oh, a week-long run, along with a very special series of curated films that inspired the Time Bomb Y2K crew. Cyberspaces and Millennial Traces.
Whoa.
Five very cool documentaries.
That's a really cool title, and not just because it rhymes. Like, it sounds cool and is very appropriate.
Marley thought of it.
Thank you.
How does this fascination, let's just dive into it. How did this fascination with Y2K begin?
Yeah. So I work as an archival producer, and as part of the job, most of the job is watching, you know, researching and watching footage. And so back in 2020, I was working on a film and, you know, was just kind of trawling through archives, looking for material. And came across a news package focused on a family making final preparations for Y2K and the potential end of the world. And it hit me like this was this major event from my childhood that passed kind of with a whimper and that I remembered well from the time, but that I hadn't given one second of thought since. And, you know, Marley and I had worked together on a film called Spaceship Earth, and we knew we wanted to make a movie that we directed together and kind of had a years long running G chat of movie ideas, both good and bad. And Y2K was a good one. And so I sent it over to Marley as a potential topic to make a film about. And we kind of took it from there.
Yeah, I was in my summer of what I was calling defining digital, where I was trying to get to the bottom of what it meant for something to be digital, partly inspired by a ScreenSlate series, actually, at Anthology Film Archives, which was the last three movies I saw in theaters before lockdown.
Yeah, yeah. The 1995 series, which yeah. I think like the last film that showed in New York was probably like Johnny Mnemonic or Strange Days or something.
Yeah, I think it was Strange Days because I was there and then I walked out and it was some seriously Strange Days.
Burning cars. Yeah. And,
which is a Y2K movie.
Yeah, and so. A few seconds of it may make an appearance at DCTV and then on HBO later.
Yeah. So I was already in this mindset of really like cyber world and being very interested in movies from the 90s about that. And then Brian and I started talking about Y2K and how there wasn't a movie out there, which is a huge point.
Yeah, shock.
Total shock.
I'm kind of surprised, actually. There's like none whatsoever. I mean, not to like totally put you on the spot. Yeah.
Yeah, but no. There's a film called A Day in the Hype of America made by TJ Martin, who also made a film that we're actually big fans of, LA 92, which was an all archival look at the LA riots. That he made as his like college thesis project, but that was all filmed on 12/31/99. So no one has really done a retrospective look at it with any space. There've been like television episodes. There was like a weird Vice 30-minute Hulu episode focused on Y2K that came out a couple years ago, but no one's done a feature doc.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, which was surprising. And, you know, the further we looked into it, when you Google Y2K, the first images that come up are like empty grocery store shelves and people lined around the block at gun stores and sort of the same subcultures in America that were pervading the media landscape then were also around in 2020, the summer of 2020. So we made this connection immediately and realized that there was like a lot to dig into beyond just, you know, this, what we think of as Y2K today, but actual computer error and that effect on society. So then I had actually already worked with Penny very briefly on this idea of Penny Lane.
Penny Lane, who also, I should add, has played a pivotal role in ScreenSlate history. Because I met her like 3 days after I started it in like 2011. She was like, oh, you should send like a daily email. It's like, whoa. And that is why we have the daily email.
Wow.
Yeah. Credit to Penny Lane.
Oh, shout out. Yeah.
Yeah. She has a lot of good ideas.
Yeah. So I had worked with her briefly on something that Y2K was sort of nestled in. And we had talked about it before. And so when Brian and I decided, you know, this was the movie we wanted to make, we thought, let's reach out to Penny and just talk to her about it because we knew she had an interest in it.
Yeah. I messaged Marley and I remember you saying, you know, who's obsessed with Y2K is Penny Lane. And so she played an early and integral role in kind of getting behind us and telling us it was a good idea worth pursuing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, do you have like personal memories of Y2K? Like, I mean, I kind of remember it being a big deal, like leading up to it. But then once it happened, it was like, yeah, just kind of like nothing. And then it was just, everyone just like forgot about it. But
yeah, I remember sitting in the TV room of my parents' house on 12/31 and watching the fireworks go off in Auckland, New Zealand, and above the Sydney Harbour Bridge. In Sydney, because those were the first two major cities to pass the dateline. And I remember the hype leading up to it in some ways, not in an especially detailed or journalistically relevant way. But I remember seeing those fireworks successfully going off in the news reports and thinking like, okay, this is going to be all right. And then kind of sitting around for the rest of the day, watching the world experience the millennium until it finally reached New York.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
But not with like anyone other than my mom and dad there.
Yeah,
there,
yeah.
There was no big party or anything of that sort.
I did go to a party, which I remember at the Easton's house.
shout out to the Easton family.
Yeah, shout out to the Easton's. And I remember blowing up paper bags and popping them at midnight because that's what Nickelodeon had told us to do for like a month ahead of time.
Yeah. Were you like swinging gack around and
absolutely.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Wearing your Hey Arnold t-shirt or I don't know.
Exactly. Exactly that. Yes.
In our dream.
That's the image I have of myself at that age. But when we first started getting into this project, I did ask my parents like what was up? What did we do? And my mom said that we filled the bathtub with water just because we didn't want to be idiots.
Oh, whoa.
And
yeah.
We went to Circuit City that day to buy batteries.
Oh, damn. I haven't thought about Circuit City in a while. I was pretty hyped on Circuit City back in the day.
My dad worked for Circuit City until 2 years ago. And so
whoa.
Going there on Y2K day didn't stand out because we were there every weekend.
Yeah, yeah. Did you like roll up with like VIP access to like...
No, it wasn't like that. I wish.
There's like a massive line. People are going crazy and your dad's just like... Like, stick with me.
Yeah, like taking me through the CD section.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it wasn't quite like that.
Or just a hello.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like in my family, I don't have specific memories, but I feel like by the time New Year's came around, my parents were kind of like over it. You know, like, I think my dad was definitely, you know, he was the kind of guy who was super uptight about like, antivirus software on the computer and really about like protecting the computer. But I kind of feel like he chilled out by the time Y2K rolled around. Wow. I don't think he thought, yeah.
Yeah,
I think he knew it was, yeah.
That's, yeah, early cyber threat awareness, honestly.
Yeah, yeah.
MacSafe.
But it's also that,
like defragmentation and
oh, yeah,
and
yeah.
Stuff,
defragging like, the hard drive.
Like all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's like the stuff, I mean, especially, I think maybe this is still a bit of a thing, but especially back then, it was like, all the security stuff probably fucked up your computer more than it helped it to like make you kind of like play into this kind of cycle of paranoia that you needed to have more and more software. Like John McAfee kind of, that was like his whole thing before he fled to Thailand or whatever. But
yeah, well, that was definitely like a phenomenon during Y2K, like yeah. Selling fixes for computers and like just insisting that you have to buy this new software. And I think
right.
A lot of what happened around Y2K was just buying new products and
yeah,
replacing your old ones.
And yeah. a lot of that was overhyped, but you know, a lot of those system upgrades were real and necessary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, we have so much footage in the collection of like people running the tests, you know, footage in our archive that we used to make the film of like people setting the clock to change it to, you know, January 3rd to see if the computer still functioned or
right.
If it went back to 1900 and like,
well,
you
yeah,
know,
I mean, couldn't they just test it by setting their computers to like 1159, it, you know, and then just seeing if they blow up like then?
That's what people did for years and
yeah,
for years.
Yeah.
And the tests were run and people figured it out. And
yeah.
I mean, the experts weren't saying the computer would blow up at midnight, but they were saying it might malfunction. So again, we have so many hours of just computer testing that I think at some point along the road, we thought that would be, and we do use quite a bit of that, but I got pretty into the idea of testing as like a container of footage, and at one point thought was like, oh, this is gonna be such a huge part of the movie, we're gonna watch all these tests and they're not that thrilling, you know, like like getting taken inside of a Wall Street bank and just watching a room full of men like clicking test and kind of muttering to each other, never quite transformed into the verite feeling scene that perhaps I thought it might be at some point. But we have some nice tests there.
There was that interesting Y2K drill that was like a community gathered together.
you know, I love that piece of
footage. Yeah. And then they
this is like a B-side or like something
that was... It's a B-side. Yeah. They like acted out scenarios of what could go wrong, one of which was like rioting.
It's like fucked.
Yeah, it was really...
They seemingly hired homeless people for this one day task of playing like actors losing it as a result of Y2K. And this is government. Yeah. This was government funded.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was convinced I could find a bunch of footage like at the National Archives because this was taxpayer dollars.
It's like a Riotsville kind of thing.
Yes.
It was a riot. Yeah. And like police on horseback, if I'm recalling correctly. Police on
We were so deep in it when I saw Riot, like watched Riotsville for the first time.
Directed by Sierra Pettengill. Shout out to Sierra.
Yeah. Who's doing a Q&A as part of this.
Oh, series. Sick. Whoa. Yeah.
And yeah, that like while watching that film, I was like, I gotta send this Y2K hypothetical riot from like the late 1998 in the Bay Area.
Yeah, yeah.
Over because this continued happening.
You know? Whoa. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, just getting back to the archival nature of the film, like what made you decide to tell the story archivally? I mean, obviously that's like part of your background, but yeah, I mean, what kind of discussions did you have about that framework?
Yeah, I mean, it's our first film, but we've both worked on a bunch of archival films between ourselves. And I think we just wanted to see if it was possible from the start as kind of an experiment in form, but also just in, you know, can we make this feel as immersive as possible? Like there were such strong emotions and heightened emotions during the last days of the last millennium. And we wanted to keep people in those as much as possible. We also were aided by the fact that it was on television, you know, every major network every night. And they're, you know, not just news hits, but also kind of longer form pieces. So we knew that there was the necessary material out there. That was a big part of like the early days of researching the film was, you know, like, you ask yourself, can you do it? And then we spent kind of a year before really diving into it, just researching the film while both of us work full time on other projects on nights and weekends and kind of came up with this bedrock collection of material where we were like, man, this is already 100 hours and we've had very little money put into this project to digitize other stuff. And there's so much more out there that we can get to.
Yeah. I would say for me, having limitations at the beginning of any process is just really helpful and gives you an avenue to just start working.
Yeah.
And so it was, you know, during that year we edited a sizzle, you know, a 10-minute version, a 3-minute version, a 6-minute version.
Yeah. And took it to Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly.
We ran it up the ladder at Hollywood.
At Hollywood, yeah. And it was like through doing that that we realized we could actually edit something like compelling with just archival. Yeah. Yeah.
And it was also the pandemic. So shooting involved jumping through a ton of hoops. And we also had no money to hire crew with. And because of, you know, like years of doing archival research for films, I have relationships with vendors and networks and archives. And so we were able in this way to just get like tons and tons of footage without having to hire a DP or a sound guy, and we were just able to do it from our desks.
I'll add that we also did interviews, or not, you know, on film interviews, but we did interviews for research with all of the main characters in our film. And one of the first things that stood out to us is that they are saying the same things now about Y2K that they were saying in the 90s. And we would be talking to them and say, yeah, we've heard you say that in footage. So like, we don't really need these
still kind of embedded
talking heads reflecting back and making these connections because it's all there in the footage. And like I said, it was immediately resonant, you know, these ideas and what people were sharing. So we knew we could craft the film in a way so that it spoke to our present moment just by what was actually happening in the 90s. The old history repeats itself idea.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking, I guess, of the characters in the film, there's a gentleman whose name is escaping me, but is, I think, becomes kind of a main character in terms of being the first to sound the alarm bells and then also becoming the subject of controversy insofar as, you know, these sort of like Chicken Little, Boy Who Cried Wolf kind of things. Like, is he being overly alarmist? Is he generating all this press and speaking engagements for himself or his own personal gain?
Peter de Jager.
Like, at what point was it clear that he would be such a main part of the film? I mean, maybe the answer to that is kind of obvious, but it would be interesting to hear you talk about that.
Yeah, I think really early on, because he's one of the only names that repeats itself again and again and again throughout the entire story of Y2K. And we immediately came across, you know, multiple news clips of him. And so we realized that he was there from the beginning. I will say he was also doing a podcast about his Y2K experience that he was releasing. And when we first started researching the film, it's one of the first things we came across. And he tells his own story there, and he tells you that he was there from the start and through the end. So we knew that this person existed and that we could rely on him to kind of keep coming back to remind us, you know, about the technical problem and his role in translating that to people.
Yeah. Yeah. We knew he was a guy you could trace. You see like one appearance of his and think, okay, like this guy's pretty interesting. He's bombastic. Mm-hmm. He's an ex-programmer. He's been there since the start. And, you know, then you run that name through a few archive searches and you hit on the fact that he was in the news constantly. So he was someone you could trace. And he's just a really interesting figure, you know. He was there early. He was alarmist. And then, you know, he did make some money off of it presented with the opportunity, but he always kind of kept a consistent message. And then towards when, as 2000 approached, when the problem had been worked on, after he'd constantly kind of insisted that we invest in it and work on it, and that actually happened, he sort of eased his tone and said, and it's in our film too, you know, said that we've done a good job working on this, and he doesn't foresee any sort of major disaster.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's like, he wears ties with clocks on them, and he's over the top, and he has a dark sense of humor. And we corresponded with him throughout, and he was a huge help to us. And we do have another podcast appearance coming up on his podcast.
Oh, so, shit.
Whoa. No competition.
Competing podcast.
Okay. Yeah, you're not the only podcast in this world that wants it.
Complimentary.
Yeah, I'll just add that I think from the get-go, like hearing the way he talked on his podcast, we were like, this guy's a storyteller. Like he's, you know, an amazing character in life and to have for a movie. And on the first episode of his podcast, he talked about, which is actually in the film, his experience of watching this show called Connections with James Burke, which happened to be like my obsession in my summer of defining digital. And I was like, I trust this guy.
Yeah. Just gives off a good vibe.
He came to our premiere in Toronto too. Like we're still in touch with him. Yeah. I spent 2 days in his basement outside of Toronto while making the film.
Okay. Did you like crash there?
No. Oh. That's maybe a step too far.
Crossing ethical boundaries.
Yeah.
We don't want to call you out on the screen slate.
I just opened up a whole can of worms. No, I hung out there and then went back to the hotel after long days of sifting through papers and CDs and pamphlets and photos.
Yeah. But I mean, also, you know, you were talking earlier about how at a certain point he started to kind of sort of lower his tone or just kind of like try to take on a little bit more of a reassuring role rather than like sounding the alarm. And of course, I think a lot of that is because, as we were talking about even earlier, like it becomes, when there's a panic, it's also like a money-making opportunity for gun manufacturers, supermarkets, you know, like you were saying, computer programs. And I think that's an aspect of the sort of hysteria that you capture really well in the film. You know, it's not like you know, I think sometimes when people talk about Y2K, it's in this really simplistic, almost superficial way. Like, people went crazy. But, like, you know, I think the footage you have and the way you edit it, you know, really, I think, takes you to that moment of how this kind of profiteering worked. And, you know, it also reminds me again of, like, after 9/11, when it was like, everyone buy duct tape, or, you know, during COVID. And, you know, we see this, I don't know, time and time again, but
yeah, there's a scene in our film of this expo that was Y2K expo. And there's this line by this guy, Robert Roskin, who I actually talked to. He actually sent my dad a book after we talked, because he wrote a book about Bob Marley and sent it to my dad. Anyway,
wait, is your dad Bob Marley?
Yeah, that's my namesake. No.
Worked at Circuit City and
and is Bob Marley.
Kingston, Circuit City.
But he says, like, you know, you're used to seeing people out at these expos for some sort of like religious reasons.
Yeah.
But now people are out, like everyone is out here. And it was this giant, like, expansive moment where, like, these expos, which were usually relegated to like subcultures, like gun people who would buy guns, suddenly the market was, you know, tenfold because of Y2K. And it's really interesting how that happened. There's also, you know, one thing we didn't get into the film, but there were a lot of like Y2K scams that were happening as well, just like using the panic and fear to get people to buy things and also to just extract money from people.
Yeah,
we thought about it. You know, it's like a computer problem that's largely worked on in cubicles and war rooms, you know, quote unquote war rooms. And then we kind of trace it out to the fringes of society, and then watch as sort of what are fringe ideas, like going to a survivalist expo, then move back towards the center when just your average, you know, citizen is now at the survivalist expo picking up dried food and knives in advance of potential crisis.
Yeah.
And there were thousands and thousands of these, and, you know, they went on tour, like the expos went on tours and moved through America, and lots of people cashed in on it.
It's interesting too, because the actual technical problem of Y2K started as an economic issue. The problem being that there wasn't enough storage space for all four digits of the year date. So they dropped the first two digits and just wrote, instead of 1968, just wrote 68.
And then
it's just an interesting sort of loop of, I don't know, like starting as an economic issue, turning into a technical issue, becoming a social issue. These patterns.
And I mean, speaking of, just the larger social issues, I think the way that you capture the broader climate of anticipation and reactions to the changing of the millennium is really fascinating. And, you know, earlier when we were talking about like what were we doing during Y2K, I was trying to put my mind at, like, it was 15 years old, and like in 1999, I was like watching a lot of movies. I was like really kind of coming of age as like a cinephile. And then that was the year that you had all these films like The Matrix and like American Beauty and Fight Club that were like, look closer, you know, or Eyes Wide Shut, you know. It was like every film was kind of about like the hidden reality underneath reality.
Yeah.
And that's something I think, you know, it was really like insightful of you to weave that into the film, and you do that in a really wonderful way, thinking of like the cultural context. And
That was really important to us, just how much apocalypse was in the air, but not just an apocalypse, also this like kind of hope-filled desire to escape from the ashes of the world that was ending and move on to a new millennium, or, you know, a new place. And I mean, it wasn't just movies, it was music videos, it was advertising. There was this real kind of twin obsession, it seems, with both the world ending and this kind of like outer space adjacent new reality that we could create for ourselves, in which our problems are smoothed over and and blobby in form.
I love those movies. I think that's a great observation. The idea of the movies coming out saying like, look closer. I think that's a really good way to put it. That was really important. That was an important scene to me because I think that so often we leave like mass culture out of the conversation and trying to like explain a moment. And often it's just reflective of exactly what's going on. And I think that like by allowing ourselves to expand the definition of like what the archive is to blockbuster movies. It really helped solidify that.
It also takes some tactful deploying and contextualization and edit to include that.
I mean, we found a guy who wrote a book about like culture spiraling out in the 90s. One of his big things was like tattoos and like people changing their bodies. And like, this is a way for us to get ready for the future of like, you know, cyborg realities. But yeah, he was interviewed like maybe two or three times about that book. And so that was like such a great find to be able to bring him in to explain why this was, you know, in the movie. To set it up as like, this is an important thing to look at.
Are there any avenues you had considered pursuing that felt like too far or like too outside the scope of what you were trying to do?
Yeah. I mean, more for one, the riot we just practice riot we just talked about. We also had a whole collection of footage of Americans who went to Jerusalem await the rapture, kind of conflating these ideas of the technological end of the world with the apocalypse as described in the Bible.
Yeah. But is there's still some of that.
Yeah, I mean, not that specific. Yeah, there's some televangelists.
Yeah. But this, yeah, I guess these were specifically people who went to Jerusalem to kind of sing in caves and wait for that fateful day.
Yeah.
And really, as hard as we tried to turn them into fully formed characters, there wasn't much out there except footage of them singing in caves.
Yeah.
It felt like every network went to Jerusalem and filmed this group of people singing with their arms raised. And then there was no chance for them to really
like explain
what they were doing or explain their belief system in full. And we didn't want to include characters where, like you said earlier, where people just remember Y2K is like, whoa, that was crazy. Like scene, although it was like so visually and orally alluring, it was like there was nothing deeper. And we did think the televangelists kind of hit the religious beat in a better way.
Yeah, I think specifically with them, because I think we did edit some cool scenes with them, really interesting scenes, but it took a lot of understanding of why they were there and what the danger was of them being there, which was like diving into like what the Book of Revelation said and the Dome of the Rock, like all of these. It took a lot of explaining, which ended up kind of dragging in the movie.
We really liked those scenes, but at some point had to say goodbye.
I'll darlings, say the other thing that I have that I wish that we could have gotten in is that there were a lot of like have the first baby of the millennium competitions radio shows had. And they like radio shows 9 months out from the millennium paid people. They like, you know, you submitted to some contest and then if you got chosen, they picked like 10 couples. They paid for like a honeymoon suite at a hotel for them to make a baby as a competition of who would have the first millennium baby. And we had like a lot of those.
Like sweepstakes were much bigger back then. And what about the thing that was like, wasn't there some like dating expo clip that was kind of millennium focused?
Oh yeah, it was like everyone's trying to find a date for New Year's Eve 1999. That's the hottest night to have a date. And so it was like singles looking. And then there was a giant wedding. There was also a giant wedding in a mall with like a preacher on stage. And then there was like hundreds of couples who got married that day on New Year's Eve 1999. That's sort of like little stuff that was like, oh, I just want to find the right place for this. and it didn't find its place.
But we do have a Millennium Baby.
We do not have a Millennium Baby.
Not to spoil the film.
But yeah. No. One baby was born.
There was a baby born.
We don't know if there were any radio shows involved, but...
There were some people who won sweep... Like, we know from research, like, people did win the sweepstakes, and there were debates between, like, who actually had the kit. And this is, like, TMI. But, like, doctors were waiting for midnight to pass to birth these kids.
Oh, I see.
Like,
yeah,
specifically planning it so that it occurred, you know, at like 1 second.
But like, how do you clock it? Like, is that what is like the photo finish?
See, that's what we needed. We needed those
You're
answers.
Checking it on the atomic clock. Yeah. Like, there's
like if but we like, had those answers, they would be in the film, but we never found them.
But even just like in general, how do you determine when a baby is like born?
That, I don't honestly. Know. Do you know? Amazing question.
You know, it's like when, I guess, is it when it's like head pops out?
Yeah, or? Like full body out.
Yeah, it's like the moment the toe comes out. It's like
no, not born.
Hit the stopwatch.
Not born. Full body out is what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm taking a hard stance.
You like cut the umbilical cord. yeah. No, but also just like with time zones, you know, like. Yeah, so there's like multiple New Year's babies.
I think the sweepstakes were state by state.
Yeah, it was. Right.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I like, or like radio station by radio station.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, something I think I mentioned before is like that really struck me about the film is the way all the footage kind of fits together aesthetically. And like this maybe feels like a minor thing to call out, but like the color correction I thought was like really amazing because it's like every piece of footage retains its sort of unique visual identity, and yet they like fit together. And I think that's like an interesting balance where you don't want to like overly conform everything, but you also don't want everything to like clash. Yeah.
Yeah. Not at all. A minor thing to call out. shout out to our colorist, Brian Boyd, who did an amazing job. You know, one of the first things that really attracted us to this project was using footage specifically from this time period. It just, watching footage from the 90s puts you in the 90s. You know, there was just such a small window that footage looked like this.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and it's like so,
like standard definition digital, you know, it was like digital before HD,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, and tape. And, you know, we felt very strongly like when onlining, you're kind of faced with this decision. Do you want to make it look like clean?
Yeah.
And we felt very strongly like, no, we wanted every little bit of noise at the bottom of the screen to stay on, like, you know, how it actually looked. But I will say that our colorist was, I mean, Brian Boyd did an amazing job. There were clips in there that I had been looking at for, you know, a year and a half that were completely yellow, and I never questioned that at all.
Uh-huh.
And then he got in and just like made it come alive. And that was a huge, just like bringing out that sort of saturation, the tape saturation.
Yeah.
I think has a lot to do with it. So even though there's different color palettes and everything, this medium is so specific and like the information it actually offers.
Especially to like that specific time period. It's like this brief moment between, you know, I mean, relatively brief.
Yeah.
Moment between film and digital.
Yeah.
Where networks are still just, you know, their materials backed up on tapes in vaults. And
was
digitizing that material anew. And I'm glad you picked up on that because that was really our instruction to Brian, who we both loved working with, was like, we just want to create some continuity between shots so that it doesn't feel discordant. But we do want to keep the original character of the footage. And I think we both Marley and I feel as if there's this awful tendency to up-res and over-smooth and make things look really, really sleek.
Yeah, you didn't do like the AI upscale.
No.
120 FPS.
We almost.
I'll be real. I tried it for a few clips.
Yeah.
Well, some clips are like, you know, 260 by like I want to use this clip.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, we didn't do
it just
that.
It still doesn't quite look right. Or at least it didn't quite look right to us.
Movie.
And I think we also just, you know, have this immense joy of kind of editing in 4:3 and showing it in theaters in 4:3 and
Wait, is the entire movie in 4:3?
Almost.
Except for the animations. Yeah, most of it is. And the blockbuster movies.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which are Blu-ray size.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever find clips that, like, let's say maybe you found something low res on YouTube and you were like, we have to get like the, go to the archive and get like the proper tape.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Definitely.
Definitely. As much as possible, you try to research at the source because it's so hard to just find an upload on YouTube and trace it back. But inevitably, you know, when you're hurting for a clip, mm-hmm. like Marley and our other editor, Maya, you can find something on YouTube and check back in with myself and our other archival producer, Peter Knopfs. And then we would see if we could find it. We found a bunch of, especially Peter Knopfs, co-producer on our film, split their archival research with me. And also Shelby Fintech and Kishagra Carr, kind of our research team, found some home videos on YouTube, and we didn't want to source those unless we could license them properly from the people. Mm-hmm. So we went back, like Peter would see that this guy posted a video of his son's football game in a town in Ohio, and then see how many John Z's existed in a small town in Ohio, and then would find the guy and email him, and he would have the original tape. And so we would FedEx the tape out and retransfer it and send it back to him. So yeah, there was quite a bit of that. And sometimes you couldn't find it any higher quality and you're just stuck working with like 360p. But
yeah. But I mean, noticeably, like, none of the footage looks like you just pulled shit off YouTube. Like, which is, I mean, I feel like maybe that sounds like faint praise, but like so many documentaries.
I think it's because of this process. It's like Brian and Peter and Shelby and Carr, like, you know, really diving in and reaching out to people. Cause we did work in the edit with a lot of stuff off YouTube, but then, you know, they came through and found where it came from. YouTube is such a black box, you know, it's like,
yeah,
you don't know username 01897 65. Like, how are you ever find who posted like this?
Googling that and finding an old message board post and then triangulating that with
exactly. Like, we're like sticklers about, just from years of archival, or like I'm a stickler about like I know how it'll look in the film I know when it's gonna look shitty. So, you know, we knew we had to do better when we came across clips like that.
And that's like super helpful to have like, you know, people with a bank of knowledge of like that as you're editing. And when Brian would say like, we're never going to get that clip, and I would be like, no, but ultimately, you know, it saved us headaches down the road, because how disappointing it is to, like, you know, see the final thing and it looks as shitty as it's always looked, you know?
Yeah. And also, I mean, like you're saying, the medium kind of tells part of the story, like the quality, you know, was, the medium is the message, man.
Well, yeah. I would say too, like, one of the things that attracted us to this project is not seeing a lot of archival films that are like mostly VHS. I think that's changed in the last few years.
And
but,
DV too.
Yeah, and DV. But we are both really attracted to that. I mean, it's like the aesthetic of growing up for us,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
so
totally.
It's like, yeah.
And it's often, I think, like, aestheticized in this kind of like Stranger Things way, where it's like the fake VHS filter and like,
oh, sure.
Or even, I mean, I understand like why filmmakers have to do this a lot of times, but like screen replacement in movies where you see like the CRT looks like HD shit on it. Mm-hmm. I fucking hate that shit. So yeah, I mean, it like, at what point did you feel like you were kind of done with this story? Like, at what point do you kind of like realize you have like the film?
Good question. It's a constant state of becoming, I think, until you have to deliver it. I mean, we worked with HBO, so we had deadlines from the start. Mm-hmm. And that's super helpful. And now I mean, I've always worked with deadlines on the other films I've worked on, but like, it just having mile markers planned out so you know what you're working for just changes the way that you work. So we had a deadline and we knew we had to finish the film by then. We had no more money. it's one of those things where we had 700 hours of archival footage, and you never feel like, I don't know, it does feel at points like it could be eternal. Mm-hmm. But there are these moments along the way where you get closer and closer and you're like feeling that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think like establishing those themes that you have at the beginning, I think you lose sight of for like 7 months, and then you find again, and then you're in the finishing state. That's at least like every film I've ever worked on has been that sort of, yeah.
Yeah, there were certain scenes that we knew were knocked out kind of earlier than other scenes that just felt really on point. And so you're kind of working through them, and then you have less and less left, and you're making sure that everything's in the right order. And at a certain point, it clicks. And then I don't know if this is a result of having a deadline or a deadline being placed at the exactly correct time, but it felt like with 2 weeks left, like we just had minor tweaks. And then you can kind of work on those forever. But we were feeling like movement from scene to scene was really strong, and we were hitting the emotional notes that we wanted to. And I also think just showing it to other people is kind of an underrated but helpful part of this process. Like having outside eyes on it, you know, just having really great people screen rough cuts and fine cuts and your pick locks, mm-hmm. and hearing back from them, I think was a very useful tool. Also hearing from the other members of our team, our other editor, Maya, and the people we mentioned before who did the research. And I don't know, we all really trusted each other. So once we kind of began being in agreement that we were really close, it kind of hit like, oh, maybe we are really close to being done. And I don't think it fully hit that we'd finished it until we did sound mix for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Once we watched it with sound mix, we were like, it's a movie. Actually. Yeah.
For the exact reason that we had done sound mix, it was like, oh, it all came to life.
Yeah.
Shout out Tom Paul, sound mixer.
We've been sound mixing all week, and we had this like Sunday. We were like, ugh, I guess we got to watch it down one more time on a Sunday at 10 p.m. or something. And and then we thought it would feel like it took forever to get through it for us, and it felt like it passed in 20 minutes, and we were like
we've never seen that movie.
Anyway,
who made that?
I just want to pick up on something that Brian said, which is like our team, and trusting our team. That was to me the greatest part of making this whole movie, is that we had just an amazing team, and I think we shouted out a lot of them already, but I'm going to do it again. Kushagra Grakar, Shelby Fintech, Peter Knopfs, Katie Ann Gonzalez, and Maya Muma, and Brian and I. And we would meet every Tuesday and talk, or every Wednesday, and talk about the film for hours. Mm-hmm. And it was like every Wednesday we're going to meet, and everyone's going to have the opportunity to voice what they're thinking about what we're doing, how we're doing it, what this movie's about, what they found, like, and just really like lay it all out on the table and make sure that everyone, you know, that space was just so important to have, to hear like every week kind of take a temperature of like where we were.
Yeah.
And it, I just feel so strongly that that's why we have the movie that we do, because we had an amazing team. And we had those conversations, and that really pushed it forward.
Yeah. And also people who didn't, you know, weren't there every day, but were integral parts of the team. Penny, obviously, remained a member. Gabriel Sedgwick and David T., consulting editor, came in at really useful moments to offer feedback.
Yeah.
And what are there any like major moments during those weekly meetings that stand out, like major epiphanies or revelations that maybe changed the direction of the film?
I would say I'm really prone to epiphanies, and I probably had one once a week. I would be like, yes, that's it. That's the way it's going.
Yeah.
That's
what it is. I feel like we probably had some epiphanies that put us back 2 weeks.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Like, exactly. Yeah, like
now that we look back at it.
But they put the film forward.
Yeah. Well, you got to go back to go forward.
Exactly.
Of course.
One step backward, two steps forward. Yeah.
And like also, I guess too, like if there are, I don't know, like, you know, young filmmakers listening to this, like how do you put that team together? Like how do you meet those people or find your kind of crew, both metaphorically and literally?
Yeah. I mean, this is where working with HBO comes in. Was like, there was a version of this, you know, Marley and I as first time filmmakers, like we were set to make this just Marley and I, you know? And with the help of others and people we'd worked with or people who we respected, we're kind of able to, after a year, pretty much just ourselves working on it, we're able to pitch it. And that was like the best part of having real funding for the project, was getting to hire like Shelby Fintech, who like lived in Florida and moved to New York. And I got to, you know, we got to bring her on as a PA. Like I started as a PA on OJ Made in America, where I like built desks and took trash out, but also got to learn all this stuff about filmmaking and to be able to, like, I don't want to say gift that because it's really hard work, but to be like, we've worked every step of the production ladder, from like intern and transcriptionist up to now directing. So I think we had really like useful ideas that were only through years of experience working in these roles on how to create like ideal creative and collaborative conditions for a team. And yeah, I mean, we'd worked with some of these people. We like purposefully put out a super open call for hiring, because I think like too often these jobs are just purely word of mouth, which is a big issue with the doc community, like how much people's friends and like that first foot in the door can be really tough. So we tried to open it up super wide, and just interviewed people and saw who had the skills that we needed and who seemed like they would have a great vibe to have in the office every day. And I think it really, it felt really synergistic.
Yeah, more and more, I think that this point that Brian made about, you know, Brian and I both starting as PAs and working all of these different jobs in film is like the definition of how we direct. Like, I think it's such a massive part of like our understanding of who we want to be as directors and what we want the space to be for people working on a film of ours. And that's like something that has only really clicked with me in the last like 2 years. Cause so often in those times I felt very frustrated that I didn't have whatever, you know, the ultimate call or anything, you know, or people weren't asking my feedback. And so being able to be in the position where you can ask for people's feedback and you make sure you that you
take
do
it. Yeah.
Like was really, really so rewarding. Yeah.
They're like, everyone on our team has ideas that made the final cut.
Yeah.
For sure. Like, this would be a way different movie if we'd had a different 100% team or even one different person. And so,
but it's also the fact that we worked on other people's films, which is how we met the people that we ended up working with. I mean, like, I met Penny because I worked with David Teague. We both worked with David Teague. And then after that film, David said, "You should meet Penny, like, meet my friend." And then we worked together, you know, and it's just, it really is like, I value now so much how much I learned from working on other people's films.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that's the advice to young filmmakers, is just, you know, try and get out there and collaborate as much as possible.
Yeah.
And to producers, I would say, open the door wider for people and don't just hire, you know, family friends as children and... people who've been able to work on paid internships.
Right. So I guess we should also talk about the series that you're doing around it at DCTV, Downtown Community Television. I don't know why I keep...
I love that you're doing name. That. I was like, wait, that's what it stands for?
The Firehouse.
the Firehouse. Do you want to talk a little bit? I mean, we don't have to get like, you know, super deep into it, but it would be cool to know about like the films you selected and the ways they kind of resonated with the project.
Yeah. Well, we've been waiting our whole lives for someone to ask us, which movies do you want to show in the theater? And Dour Messenger asked us that exact question, to which we said, yes. And so now, yeah, we programmed the series of kind of influences, inspirations, favorites, all from around the turn of the millennium.
Mm-hmm.
That's playing alongside our theatrical run from the 15th to the 21st. I guess the accompanying series begins on the 16th.
But yeah, I mean, some of these, but like I actually hadn't heard of Small Town Ecstasy, which is going to show on the 16th, which looks fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Should we go down the list? I guess we could start with that one on the 16th. Yeah, Small Town Ecstasy is a movie about this born-again Christian dad from California who gets really into raving, I think, in the year 2000. And his approximately 18-year-old son gives him ecstasy at a rave. And he becomes pretty addicted to doing ecstasy. And it's a cautionary tale and a pretty bleak, anxiety-inducing story, but it has its real moments that you can't look at without chuckling a tiny bit. There's like some amazing bright yellow echo outfits, some incredible upturned, worn backwards visors. There's just all these like amazing hints of the late 90s, early aughts in America, but it's kind of, you know, there's so much nostalgia for like this style of dress right now. And this film is kind of contains the dark side of that. It's a movie I first saw in like 2011 or something.
Okay, cool.
My Danish friend was like, oh, you haven't seen Small Town Ecstasy? And so I watched it back then. And this might be the first time it's playing in a theater since it aired on HBO in 2001.
Oh, wow. Whoa.
And it's
the New York theatrical premiere.
It might maybe, be. Yeah. One of our EPs is an EP on it, actually. He's been on HBO this whole time.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And it's free because it had to be free for the rights to work. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Can't miss screening.
Truly. Yeah. Brian told me about that film at the very beginning of our project, and I watched it, and it was definitely inspo, but also really intense.
It's really
fun,
intense.
But it's also like you're watching someone spiral out. So
yeah,
be warned. Next film. Synthetic Pleasures was a massive inspiration to this film. Ayara Lee film from the 90s. She also made a film called Modulations, which was another inspiration.
Yeah, the director's name is Ayara Lee.
Yeah. But Synthetic Pleasures is just about these sort of simulated spaces in America and examining that in the 90s from like a philosophical standpoint, but also the just like being in these environments. And it's sort of juxtaposing like our cyber environment with our real simulated environments. And just kind of in my mind, it's like parsing apart the simulacrum of America in the 90s.
Whoa.
Yeah.
It's also sort of like inconceivably, I think, shot on 35mm.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Beautiful.
It's really beautiful.
Yeah.
And just has all these edits and stylistic touches that only existed for 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, like time lapses and like fisheye at an angle.
Yeah.
And just like.
Is there any like drum and bass music
yes.
in it? Yeah,
absolutely.
There's great music in
Hell
it.
Yeah.
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 And amazing, amazing cuts. It was like for me a massive inspiration. Seeing that movie, I was like, I've actually been looking for this movie like a decade
now. This has existed in my mind. Yeah. I know it has to
I have been like thinking like I should make a movie like. And then I watch it and I'm like, oh,
yeah,
that exists. And it's amazing.
It feels like an extension of yourself on screen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And after that is
skateboarding.
I'm lost on the week, but it's Monday night now and it's co-presented with Union Docs. And it's two skate videos. The Reason from 1999 and Sight Unseen from 2001. So it was filmed in 2000, back to back. Also, possibly New York theatrical premiere. Definitely been. I mean, I'm sure they premiered in like Costa Mesa, California. I don't know if they also premiered in New York.
Yeah.
But two videos I definitely like I specifically remember trying to download Sight Unseen off LimeWire or Kazaa on like dial-up internet, and then the file finally finishing, and it was an AVI, like AVI.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a PC, which could, like, I hadn't, like, I don't think VLC.
You didn't have the, like, DivX codec.
I didn't have the codec. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so I remember, like, after 2 weeks of trying, like, finally the movie finishing, and you could just hear the soundtrack. But I eventually saw it a couple of years later. It's just one of, Sight Unseen is one of my favorite skate videos of all time. And The Reason is one of the most major videos from 1999. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, for me, like, I still skateboard, and that was my...
Did you skateboard over here?
No, I drove and had to look for parking for a bit. But, you know, I skateboarded down this street, bike lane at some point.
Okay, cool.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. Like, that's just, like, my intro. Like, the first, like, my first... like conception of editing or whatever is just like syncing landing tricks to like beats and songs.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like the first time you film is like you're filming your friends skateboarding. And I think showing skate videos in a theater is just like really cool. And
yeah.
Or I think it'll be really cool. Yeah. It like never happens outside of their premieres. And usually the attendees of the premieres are like, you know, 300 like 17-year-old skateboarders.
Yeah.
So I'm psyched to show it at DCTV, and psyched they're letting us show it.
Have you made skate videos? Do you have like a filmography of...
Follow them on Instagram.
I actually, my crew like had a filmer that was already like, he already claimed the, like he bought a VX1000 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I was kind of the photographer in the crew.
Like
you need a filmer and a photographer. And the filmer was like Tracy and Vince filmed. Uh-huh. So I had like a Canon 8E1 SLR that was in my parents' basement. And I was like taking the photos.
Cool.
Yeah.
And next night, we're now at Tuesday. This is archival night.
Yeah. With Sierra Pettengill
Q&A
scheduled for afterwards. Co-presented with the newly formed Archival Producers Alliance, which is a cool,
nice
industry group to help us organize better.
Yeah.
And the film is
The Net by Stanbeck.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I know you all just had a hand in playing recently. Yeah.
I think I wrote it up a while ago, and I think I like republished my like writing about it a couple months ago, because like Spectacle was showing it.
Yeah.
Because like RIP Unabomber screening, right, memorial screening.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, it's a movie that like is also, I think, really contemporary in the way it investigates these sort of like power networks. And like, you know, one of the guys in it, I think his name is John Bachman, is like, you know, kind of the intellectual.
Yeah. Brockman.
Brockman. Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah, like intellectual enabler of like Jeffrey Epstein's whole connections to all the like physicists and scientists and shit.
Like on the island?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like I think he like helped hook him up. He kind of brokered his relationship with that community.
Yeah, because I mean, they were all there.
Yeah.
Marvin Mitsky, like.
Yeah, because he's an investment banker, but then was like rolling with.
Yeah.
Like Jonas Mekas and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like also like avant-garde scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, yeah.
So the movie is, yeah, I watched it while we were making Y2K. I think at the very beginning. And it's this sort of parallel history of the internet and power networks, I think is a great way to say it. And the filmmaker's correspondence with Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. And it's one of these movies that like I saw, and I think I reference like often in my thinking, and I have to go see at DCTV because mm-hmm. I'm like, I forget what is in there. Like yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, this movie definitely like helped me have a deeper understanding of, it was made in 2002, I think, just like internet, like the kind of like fundamental philosophy.
Yeah, behind, yeah, yeah.
Behind this network that we were, you know, was a major part of our story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It also, I mean, there's so many shots of like, it's like film, like cameras filming TVs or cameras filming computer screens with computer screens playing video files.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we also, you know, if you see our film, are big fans of cameras filming computer screens.
So yeah.
I think there's some resonances there.
Yeah, totally. Also pre-YouTube, like people forget streaming video on the internet before YouTube, you know, like shout out to Real Media.
Yeah, Real Media Files.
Yeah, yeah.
And the next night, Wednesday night, is our edit night, co-presented with the Alliance of Doc Editors, and the edit team will be up there. Maya Muma, Katie Ann Gonzalez, myself, Carla Gutierrez is going to do the Q&A, and we are playing We Live in Public, a very important film.
Yeah, a doc that has, you know, Y2K is a major point in that documentary.
Yeah.
As the this kind of bunker of turn of the millennium .com bubble adjacent group of artists and creatives go through a weird social experiment where they live in a bunker in Tribeca. I haven't seen that movie in a couple of years, actually, but it's like a group of people sign up for this experiment in which they live in a bunker underneath Tribeca for a set amount of time. And
they're filmed constantly. Oh, and they're also shown themselves on TV constantly. So they're always being filmed and surveilled. And there's also an arsenal of guns, which is why they got kicked out on New Year's Eve, 1999. And it just so happened that like the end of their experiment coincided with Y2K that night.
Oh, damn. Yeah, I've never seen it.
Yeah, maybe that's a spoiler, but...
Oh, man.
But then it continues on with
kind of the bursting of the dot-com bubble as experienced through this charismatic or like sort of charismatic dot-com bubble millionaire guy.
Yeah, he continues the experiment by moving into a house and putting cameras on him and his partner and then live streaming that on the internet for everyone to see. So at any point you can tune into his life. So it's really this like, you know, forerunner of like reality television and social media, just like the kind of constant presence of like availability and being seen. Yeah. And it's an amazing movie. Yeah. And it is an archival movie. But the director Andy Timoner was part of the experiment and then was able to get this footage and keep telling the story afterwards.
Whoa. Yeah. There's this theme of kind of the dark side of this period for which there's so much nostalgia right now.
Yeah, definitely.
Like these things that are, you know, if you go to the mall and see the ads right now in Abercrombie, it looks like 20 years ago.
It's very like retro. Again, yeah.
And I feel this like, is like actually what was, you know.
Yeah,
there
definitely.
Wasn't just being high on ecstasy and raving. There was also getting arrested and having your house searched and like won't go too deep into
spiraling out.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, we definitely tend to like idealize the past, and good to think about the dark side.
Yeah, definitely.
But these are cool. They're all super easy, like pretty easy to watch movies. I think they're all pretty entertaining. Anxiety inducing, but
yeah,
like which is engaging. Like,
yeah, that's the line that I think we both want to straddle with our work: entertaining, thought provoking. These are the tags on Netflix.
Totally. Yeah. Cool. So yeah, I guess just to kind of reiterate, like movie premieres 15th, and then is on HBO on the 30th,
DCTV from the 15th to the 21st, I don't think we meant, I mean, we mentioned a lot of the films that are showing, but on the 15th, we're doing a Q&A with Laura Poitras and there's a party afterwards, but I think it may have just sold out. 16th, we're getting the band back together and you're doing the Q&A.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's a Screen Slate night.
Podcast live.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you have podcast live, totally. Live podcast.
Yeah. That's kind of what a Q&A is. It's
you
like a live podcast.
Yeah. We should all three stand up there and then you just hit play.
Yeah. We just like sit down and chill. Like,
and it's like Brian's like, I like Starbucks.
Yeah. 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 I don't think we actually recorded the I like Starbucks part. Okay.
Well,
yeah.
Well, so now you just let the record show Brian likes Starbucks.
Yeah, but yeah, this coffee. Yep.
I like Starbucks. Well, there's only one coffee place I like more, and it's Pete's. No, just kidding. And then the 17th, I don't think we mentioned, we're psyched. There's this guy who runs this really amazing Tumblr called the Y2K Aesthetic Institute.
Oh, sick.
Who's just kind of unearthed all these incredible images of late 90s, early aughts, like design, graphic design, architecture. Yeah, yeah. And we're bringing him out from LA and he's giving a presentation on the Y2K aesthetic.
Nice.
And then the Q&A afterwards will be with us, him, his name's Evan Collins, and the artist Aria Dean.
Cool.
And then I think we went through pretty much the rest of the lineup. Matthew Shen Goodman is doing the Q&A for Union Docs Night.
Mm-hmm.
And Sierra, Carla.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
HBO 1230.
Yeah. And check out Cyberspaces and Millennial Traces.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for being on the Screen Slate pod. It's been a total pleasure. And yeah, Time Bomb Y2K. Also, I think our end of year lists will have just dropped before we run this pod, so people can find your end of year lists.
Nice.
Yeah.
In our pod, and then they can come to the Downtown Community Television Center Firehouse Theater and see the film. And Cyberspaces and Millennial Traces.
Yeah. Yes.
Awesome.
Thanks so much for having us at Screen Slate HQ.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, John. And I've said it once, I'll say it again. Screen Slate is an integral part of my experience of New York City. And so very happy to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. No, it's a pleasure. Yeah. Brian doesn't read Screen Slate. So
No,
I'm just kidding.
I read it every day.
All right. Awesome. Yeah. Thanks so much. It's been a total pleasure. And yeah, hope to see everyone on the 16th.
Yeah, thanks again.
Signing off.
See you there.
Thanks for listening to the Screen Slate pod. Thanks Brian Becker and Marley McDonald for coming out and chatting with us, and AJ McKeon for editing this episode. Go see Time Bomb Y2K at DCTV December 15th through December 21st, or check it out on HBO on December 30. Once again, I'm doing a Q&A with the filmmakers on Saturday night at 8 p.m., and we'll also be at the M+1 holiday market earlier that day. Thanks again to our sponsor, Film at Lincoln Center. You can see Desire Expectation, the films of Edward Yang, at Lincoln Center, December 22nd through January 4th. And for our Patreon members, for being the greatest people on the planet, visit patreon.com/screenslate to become one. Thanks so much. See you soon.